the intellectual developments which led to the establishment of modern scientific methodology have heightened the danger of this partially pathological tendency. The construction of a powerful and accurate representation of the objective or shared world, a logical conclusion of the interpersonal exchange of sensory information made possible by linguistic communication, challenged belief in the reality of the mythic world, which was in fact never objective. The mythic world was always affective, although it was shared socially and contained procedural information and abstracted representation thereof, arranged hierarchically in terms of value, embodied in nonverbal procedural and abstracted imagistic and semantic form. Representation of mythic value in verbal format allowed for simple experimentation in ethics, in imagination, and then often tragically in action, and for generation of naive but effective criticism regarding traditional foundations for behavior. Nietzsche states, "For this is the way in which religions are wont to die out. Under the stern, intelligent eyes of an orthodox dogmatism, the mythical premises of a religion are systematized as a sum total of historical events. One begins apprehensively to defend the credibility of the myths, while at the same time one opposes any continuation of their natural vitality and growth. The feeling for myth perishes, and its place is taken by the claim of religion to historical foundations." Sigmund Freud maintained, as an ideal 19th-century empiricist, that, quote, "There is no other source of knowledge of the universe but the intellectual manipulation of carefully verified observations, that is, what is called research, and that no knowledge can be obtained from revelation, intuition, or inspiration," end quote. He said, furthermore, that "there is no appeal beyond reason, grounded directly in observation, one would presume." This description leaves no place for the primal role of affect, or even of sensation, for that matter, in determination of wisdom. What causes me and others pain is wrong in the most basic and naive form, and also fails to address the issue of the source of scientific hypotheses in general, the narrative process. Furthermore, pure knowledge of the sensory world, what is most fundamentally, does not include knowledge about how to adapt to or behave in that world, even though the gathering of such information has obvious implications for such adaptation. Tolstoy states, "As presented by the learned and the wise, rational knowledge denies the meaning of life, but the huge masses of people acknowledge meaning through an irrational knowledge. And this irrational knowledge is faith, the one thing that I could not accept. This involves the God who is both one and three, the creation in 6 days, devils, angels, and everything else that I could not accept without taking leave of my senses. My position was terrible. I knew that I could find nothing in the way of rational knowledge except a denial of life. And in faith, I could find nothing except a denial of reason, and this was even more impossible than a denial of life. According to rational knowledge, it followed that life is evil, and people know it. They do not have to live, yet they have lived, and they do live, just as I myself had lived, even though I had known for a long time that life is meaningless and evil. According to faith, it followed that in order to understand the meaning of life, I would have to turn away from reason, the very thing for which meaning was necessary." Mythic thinking, so to speak, is also based on observation, but on observation of behavior in the world of affective experience. This means cyclical observation of action predicated upon an implicit or explicitly formulated theory of what should be, and derivation of procedural, episodic, or semantic representations thereof. This is knowledge as well, and appears, in the light of careful analysis, no more arbitrary than empirical description of the objective world. Perhaps it was necessary for science, struggling to escape from a cognitive world dominated by religious and mythical thinking, to devalue that world in order to set up an independent existence. That existence has long been established, however, but the process of devaluation, implicit and explicit, continues, even in fields theoretically separate from the strictly empirical. Northrop Frye states, "Ever since Plato, most literary critics have connected the word thought with dialectical and conceptual idioms and ignored or denied the existence of poetic and imaginative thought." This attitude continued into the 20th century with I.A. Richards' Science and Poetry, with its suggestion that mythical thinking has been superseded by scientific thinking, and that consequently poets must confine themselves to pseudo-statements. The early criticism of T.S. Eliot, though considerably more cautious than this, also exhibited an array of confusions clustering around the word thought. Since then, there has been a slowly growing realization that mythological thinking cannot be superseded because it forms the framework and context for all thinking. But the old views still persist, if in more sophisticated forms, and there are still far too many literary critics who are both ignorant and contemptuous of the mental processes that produce literature. Nietzsche states, similarly, but with somewhat more scorn, "Every age has its own divine type of naivety, for whose invention other ages may envy it. And how much naivety, venerable, childlike, and boundlessly clumsy naivety, lies in the scholar's faith in his superiority, in the good conscience of his tolerance, in the unsuspecting simple certainty with which his instinct treats the religious man as an inferior and lower type that he has outgrown, leaving it behind, beneath him, him, that presumptuous little dwarf and rabble man, the assiduous and speedy head and handiworker of ideas, of modern ideas." Mythological thinking is not mere arbitrary superstition. Its denigration, cascading even through literary criticism in recent years, is not only unwarranted, but perilous. This is not to say that religious institutions and dogmas are not prey to the same weaknesses as all other human creations. The ideas and patterns of action that underlay and generated those institutions remain of critical importance, however. Remain important for sustaining individual emotional stability, maintaining group tolerance, cohesion, and flexibility, supporting capacity to adapt to the strange, and strengthening ability to resist domination by one-sided and murderous ideologies. The idea that we have superseded such thinking is a prime example of the capacity of the semantic system to partially represent and to thoroughly criticize. This is wrong, arrogant, and dangerous. The group promotes an integrated pattern of behavior and conception of values. This is strength, in that an integrated pattern provides one message and therefore promotes unity and direction. It is also weakness, in that integration, stable, hierarchically organized structure, is inflexible and therefore brittle. This means the group, and those who identify with it, cannot easily develop new modes of perception or change direction when such change or development becomes necessary. Under stable environmental and social conditions, this is an advantage, as what worked in the past will continue to work in the present. However, in times of transition, of rapid environmental transformation, of multicultural contact, of technological or ideological advance, stability is not necessarily sufficient. The Russian neuropsychologist Sokolov stated, as cited previously, "One way to improve the quality of extrapolation, judgment of match between intent and outcome, is to secure additional information. Another method is to change the principles by which such information is handled so that the process of regulation will prove more effective. This fundamental idea is embodied in mythology in the figure of the revolutionary hero. He is the fourth manner in which threat to the stability of cultural tradition may be presented, and, simultaneously, is solution to the ever-recurring problem of such threat. The revolutionary hero. The revolutionary hero reorders the protective structure of society when the emergence of an anomaly makes such reordering necessary. He is, therefore, the agent of change upon whose actions all stability is predicated. This capacity, which should make him a welcome figure in every community, is exceedingly threatening to those completely encapsulated by the status quo and who are unable or unwilling to see where the present state of adaptation is incomplete and where residual danger lies. The archetypal revolutionary hero therefore faces the anger and rejection of his peers as well as the terrors of the absolutely unknown. He is, nonetheless, the best friend of the state. Analysis of the archaic ecstatic practice of shamanism, prevalent in Mircea Eliade's words, throughout the immense area comprising Central and North Asia, sheds further light on the nature of the actions and typical experiences of the revolutionary hero. Europeans who made initial contact with these tribal healers frequently deemed them insane. The reverse was in fact true. The genuine shaman was the most sane man of the tribe, that is, the man whose extent of adaptation was greatest. Furthermore, he served as primordial unified ancestor of the lately differentiated or specialized creative agent, explorer, mystic, artist, scientist, and physician. The Asian shaman was master of religious life, embodiment and keeper of the sacred doctrine, dominant authority, and creator of culture. The widespread practices and viewpoints of shamanism constitute a cohesive philosophy, so to speak, embedded unconsciously in behavior and image. This ritual philosophy comprises a set of observations about the nature of radical personality transformation and a set of practices designed to bring such alteration about. Shamanism is devoted to furtherance of the possibility of qualitative improvements in consciousness or general adaptive ability. It has captured the essence of such possibility in image to minimize the accompanying terror. Shamanism is prototypical of those religious practices designed to modify human behavior and interpretation, to induce and regulate the processes of spiritual reconfiguration. These practices are not merely cultural in nature. They originate in the observation of spontaneous psychological transmutation, a psychobiologically grounded human capacity. Shamanic rituals are therefore not merely anachronistic, without modern relevance, except as curiosity dictates, but prime exemplars of a process we must come to understand. The shaman is not simply an archaic figure, an interesting anomaly from the dead past. He is the embodiment, in cultures we do not comprehend, of those people we admire most in the past. The phenomenon of the creative illness, described in detail by the existential psychotherapist Henri Ellenberger in his massive study of the history of the unconscious, is alive and well in our own culture. Ellenberger described its characteristic elements. A creative illness succeeds a period of intense preoccupation with an idea and search for a certain truth. It is a polymorphous condition that can take the shape of depression, neurosis, psychosomatic ailments, or even psychosis. Whatever the symptoms, they are felt as painful, if not agonizing, by the subject, with alternating periods of alleviation and worsening. Throughout the illness, the subject never loses the thread of his dominating preoccupation. It is often compatible with normal professional activity and family life. But even if he keeps to his social activities, he is almost entirely absorbed with himself. He suffers from feelings of utter isolation, even when he has a mentor who guides him through the ordeal, like the shaman apprentice with his master. The termination is often rapid and marked by a phase of exhilaration. The subject emerges from his ordeal with a permanent transformation in his personality and the conviction that he has discovered a great truth or a new spiritual world. Many of the 19th and 20th century figures recognized unquestionably as great, Nietzsche, Darwin, Dostoevsky, Tolstoy, Freud, Jung, Piaget, were additionally characterized by lengthy periods of profound psychological unrest and uncertainty. Their psychopathology, a term ridiculous in this context, was generated as a consequence of the revolutionary nature of their personal experience, their action, fantasy, and thought. It is no great leap of comparative psychology to see their role in our society as analogous to that of the archaic religious leader and healer. For the average tribal individual, socially imposed initiation signifies the death of childhood and reintegration on the level of social maturity. For the future shaman, voluntarily undertaken initiation signifies the disintegration of socially determined adult personality and reintegration at the level of unique individuality. This process is illustrated in Figure 50, the dual death of the revolutionary hero. Those who undergo a second initiation suffer more deeply and profoundly from life than their peers. They are, in Jung's phrase, the most complex and differentiated minds of their age. These creative individuals detect emergent anomaly and begin the process of adaptation to it long before the average person notices any change whatsoever in circumstance. In his ecstasy, the shaman lives the potential future life of his society. This dangerous individual can play a healing role in his community because he has suffered more through experience than his peers. If someone in the community or the community itself becomes ill, breaks down, begins the journey, so to speak, to the land of the dead, the terrible unknown, the shaman is there to serve as guide, to provide rationale for current experience, to reunite the suffering individual with his community or to renew the community, to restabilize the paradigmatic context of expectation and desire within which individual and social experience remains tolerable. The truly creative individual has been there and done that, and can therefore serve as a guide to others voluntarily beginning or roughly thrown into similar voyages. The archaic shamanic initiate was commonly someone uniquely marked by fate, by the will of the gods, by particular heredity, magical, novel occurrence in early childhood or later in life, birth in a call, survival of lightning strike, or by intrapsychic idiosyncrasy, epileptic susceptibility, visionary proclivity. His unique personality or experiential history, in combination with presently extant social conditions, doomed him to experience so anomalous that it could not simultaneously be accepted as actually occurring, as real, and as possible within the confines determined by ruling social presumption. The existence of this experience, if admitted and processed, therefore presented a potentially fatal challenge to the perceived validity of the axioms currently underlying the maintenance of normal sanity, the socio-historically determined stability of mutually determined behavioral adaptation and experiential significance. The existence of this distinct experience served as a gateway to the unknown, or as a floodgate, a portal, through which the unexpected could pour, with inevitably destructive and potentially creative consequences. The shaman is the individual who chooses to meet such a flood head-on. The shaman, the ecstatic in general, equally the revolutionary philosopher or scientist true to himself, is characterized by stubborn adherence to his own idiosyncratic field of experience in which occurrences emerge, procedural, episodic, or semantic in structure, that are foreign to the predictably socialized man and his prosaic moral expectation. The experiential range of the creative agent transcends the domain of the current adaptive sufficiency of his culture as it is extant socially and embodied and represented intrapsychically. Rather than ignoring or failing to process such occurrences, which exist in contradiction to or completely outside his conditional socially determined expectations and acting as though they do not exist, the creative individual voluntarily admits their reality and submits himself to the dissolution of his current moral worldview and pattern of action. This dissolution of personality, equivalent in episodic representation to death, temporarily re-novelizes experience. Furthermore, it provides the precondition for more inclusive resurrection of order, personal and social. The future shaman is in fact tormented by the incomplete or self-contradictory state of his cultural structure as it is intrapsychically represented, is undergoing a breakdown induced by some aspect of personal experience, some existential anomaly that cannot be easily integrated into that structure. This breakdown re-exposes him to the unknown, previously covered, so to speak, by his culture. His comportment during the period of incubation preceding his emergence as shaman is generally marked by commission of acts considered characteristic in modern and archaic culture alike of serious mental breakdown. He behaves idiosyncratically, seeking solitude, flying into fits of rage, losing consciousness, living in the mountains or woods alone, and suffering from visions and periods of absent-mindedness. His peers explain his odd behavior as possession. This experience of dissolution and re-exposure to chaos accompanies intrapsychic subjugation to the operation of innate, involuntary, episodic, limbic, right hemisphere-governed mechanisms responsible for the deconstruction and renewal of conditional knowledge. This operation manifests itself subjectively in structured mythic experience, in spontaneous personal experience, which adheres to the pattern associated with ritualized social initiation, and which may also have served originally as its source. The soul of the shaman is carried away by spirits, habituants of the episodic realm, and returned to the place of the gods. This place exists outside of time and space itself, on the same plane of pleromatic reality as the prehistoric and post-apocalyptic paradise. Entry into this domain is preceded by complete psychic disintegration, accompanied by horrifying visions of torture, dismemberment, and death. The shamanic initiate descends into the matriarchal hell that preceded and coexists with creation, passing through clashing rocks or gates in the shape of jaws. He is reduced to a skeleton while his disembodied head observes the procedure. He has his internal organs removed or restructured, his bones are broken, his eyes gouged out. He is devoured by a serpent or a giantess, is boiled, roasted, or otherwise reduced to his essential and fundamental structure, to his very bones. Iliada states, "The total crisis of the future shaman, sometimes leading to complete disintegration of the personality and to madness, can be evaluated not only as an initiatory death, but also as a symbolic return to the pre-cosmogonic chaos, to the amorphous and indescribable state that precedes any cosmogony. Now, as we know, for archaic and traditional cultures, a symbolic return to chaos is equivalent to preparing a new creation. It follows that we may interpret the psychic chaos of the future shaman as a sign that the profane man is being dissolved and a new personality being prepared for birth." This disintegration is the removal of experience, objects, and processes from their socially determined state of provisional paradigm-governed significance and their return to the affectively numinous unknown, infinitely threatening and promising. Exposure to consequently renovelized experience constitutes the affective and motivational core of the ecstatic experience, the basis for the religious experience, and the experience of meaning as such, prior to its entrapment and canalization in dogma. Dissolution is experienced in imaginal or episodic representation as death, an accurate conceptualization, death of socialized personality. Dissolution of the presently constituted intrapsychic representation and procedural embodiment of action patterns historically constructed and currently deemed morally acceptable. The justifiable terror consideration of the consequences of such decomposition induces constitutes a major impediment to the pursuit of redemptive change, a formidable barrier to intrapsychic integration. The shamanic process of transformation appears as the means by which cognitive systems are updated when necessary. The affect that is released during the process is necessarily part of the experience. Every major step forward, therefore, has some of the aspect of the revolutionary descent into madness. Change shades gradually from the normal to the radical. The structure of this process formulates itself easily into imagistic representation, even among children far too young to develop any explicitly statable knowledge about such occurrences. The following dream was described by my daughter, Michaela, then 3 years, 9 months old, about my son, Julian, 1 year, 11 months old, on October 5, 1995. Julian was in a time of toilet training and rapid speech development and was having some trouble controlling his emotions. Michaela liked to call him Baby. We had several discussions about the fact that he really wasn't a baby anymore. She told me this story while I was at the computer, so I was able to get it verbatim. Michaela, Julian's eyes falled out and then he falled into pieces. Dad, what sort of pieces? Michaela, Julian pieces, and the bones falled out too. Then a hole got him, and there was water in it, and when he came out, he was big. Mum, Julian isn't a baby anymore? Michaela, no, he's a big boy, and a bug with legs got him out, because bugs can swim, and the hole was in the park, and it moved into the backyard, and he falled in it. A tree burned and left the hole. It was the partial dissolution of Julian's previous infantile personality that was causing his emotional distress. Michaela, upset by his trouble and curious about the disappearance of her baby, was trying to understand what her brother was going through. Her dream represented his transformation as a death and rebirth. First his eyes fell out, then he fell into pieces, then his bones came out. Everything went into a hole which originally inhabited the nearby park. The park by our house was 40 wooded acres. The children and I had gone there at night several times. They found it spooky but exciting. For them, it was the nearest manifestation of the unknown, outside explored and familiar territory. Prime locale for metaphoric application as source of the hole in which transformation takes place. The hole was full of water, whose symbolism we have partially discussed as the rejuvenating slash destroying water of life. The bug with legs that could swim was, I think, a theriomorphized representation of the very archaic intrapsychic systems that guide or underlie the transformation of more sophisticated cortical or personality contents. The notion that a tree burned and left the hole is very complex. A tree, at minimum, is a sophisticated structure that emerges from basic material, from the ground. It is also commonly used as a metaphoric representative of the essence of the individual human, even of the nervous system itself, as we shall see. The tree, in this case, was therefore also representative of Julian, but in a more impersonal way. It stood for, among other things, the personality that was currently undergoing transformation. Adaptive ability remains necessarily limited to the domain encompassed by a single set of principles, a single pattern of action, a single mode of apprehension. In the absence of capacity to reconfigure present conceptualizations of morality. Morality, description of unbearable present, ideal future, and means of transformation. Such limitation, which is the inability to play games with the rules of the games, means dangerous restriction of behavioral and representational flexibility, and increased susceptibility to the dangers posed by inevitable environmental shift. That is, by inevitable reemergence of the dragon of the unknown. Biologically determined capacity for such dissolution and for its satisfactory resolution provides the necessary precondition for the existence of human capacity for qualitative alteration and adaptation. Resolution of crisis, symbolic rebirth, follows attendant upon initiatory dissolution, dismemberment, and death. Iliadis states, "The initiatory operations proper always include the renewal of the organs and viscera, the cleaning of the bones, and the insertion of magical substances, quartz crystals, or pearl shell, or spirit snakes. Quartz is connected with the sky world and with the rainbow. Pearl shell is similarly connected with the rainbow serpent that is, in sum, still with the sky. This sky symbolism goes along with ecstatic ascents to heaven, for in many regions the candidate is believed to visit the sky, whether by his own power, for example by climbing a rope, or carried by a snake. In the sky he converses with the supernatural beings and mythical heroes. Other initiations involve a descent to the realm of the dead. For example, the future medicine man goes to sleep by the burying ground, or enters a cave, or is transported underground or to the bottom of a lake. Among some tribes, the initiation also includes the novices being roasted in or at a fire. Finally, the candidate is resuscitated by the same supernatural beings who had killed him, and he is now a man of power. During and after his initiation, he meets with spirits, heroes of the mythical times, and souls of the dead. And, in a certain sense, they all instruct him in the secrets of the medicine man's profession. Naturally, the training proper is concluded under the direction of the older masters. In short, the candidate becomes a medicine man through a ritual of initiatory death, followed by a resurrection to a new and superhuman condition. The shaman travels up and down the Axis Mundi, the central pole of the world, the tree of life connecting the lower chthonic reptilian and the upper celestial avian worlds with the central domain of man. This is the constituent elements of experience conceived in an alternative but familiar arrangement, as heaven above, farther above, underworld, matter, earth, below, mother below, conceived in the configuration arranged originally by the cosmos-creating hero. The shaman's success at completing the journey from earth to the domain of the gods allows him to serve the role of psychopomp, intermediary between man and God, to aid the members of his community in adjusting to what remains outside of conditional adaptation when such adaptation fails. The shaman therefore serves his society as active intermediary with the unknown, as the conduit, so to speak, through which the unknown speaks to man, as the agent through which the information which compels adaptive change flows. It is important to note that the shaman's journey into unknown lands must be bounded by return to the community for the voyage to be of value. Otherwise, the prototypal ecstatic experience, central to the shamanic vocation and to creative thought and action in general, is mere insanity, will be regarded socially and experienced intrapsychically as such. Resolution is psychological reconstruction, reincorporation, rebirth on a higher level, with redemptive personal experience intact, but reintegrated in the corpus of current socio-cultural myth and history. The ineradicable anomaly that comprises an eternal aspect of existence periodically undermines the stability of a subset of unfortunate but gifted individuals. Those who maintain their heads during the journey into the underworld return, contaminated by that underworld from the perspective of their compatriots, but rife with possibility for reordering the world. Such recovery is, in essence, the transformation of assumption and value, individual, then cultural. History is an invaluable storehouse of the creative experience and wisdom of the past. Past wisdom is not always sufficient to render present potentiality habitable. If the structure of experience itself was static and finite, like the past, all things would have been conquered long ago, and the lives of the ancestors and their children would differ little in kind. But the structure of experience is dynamic and infinite in possibility. The nature of experience itself varies with time. New challenges and dangers appear out of the future into the present, where none existed before. History, as description of the past, is incomplete as well as static. It must therefore exist in constant conflict with new experiences. The spirit underlying the transmutation of culture resolves unbearable intrapsychic conflict with shattering revelation, first to the individual, then to society at large. The creative individual dies, metaphysically and too often literally, for those who follow him, instead of sharing the common destiny of his peers. Those who bear the initial burden for the forward movement of history are capable of transforming personal idiosyncrasy and revelation into collective reality without breaking down under the weight of isolation and fear. Such creativity is feared and hated and desired and worshipped by every human individual and by human society in general. Creative individuals destroy old values and threaten with chaos, but they also bear light and the promise of better things. It is in this manner that the sacrifice of the revolutionary savior redeems and rekindles the cosmos. The revolutionary hero is the individual who decides voluntarily, courageously, to face some aspect of the unknown and threatening. He may also be the only person who is presently capable of perceiving that social adaptation is incompletely or improperly structured in a particular way. Only he understands that there still remain unconquered evil spirits, dangerous unknowns, and threatening possibilities. In taking creative action, he re-encounters chaos, generates new myth-predicated behavioral strategies, and extends the boundaries, or transforms the paradigmatic structure, of cultural competence. The well-adapted man identifies with what has been, conserves past wisdom, and is therefore protected from the unknown. The hero, by contrast, author and editor of history, masters the known, exceeds its bounds, and then subjects it to restructuring, exposing chaos once more to view in the process, or pushes back unknown frontiers, establishing defined territory where nothing but fear and hope existed before. The hero overcomes nature, the great mother, entering into creative union with her, reorganizing culture, the great father, in consequence. Such reintegration and resurrection is, in essence, the metamorphosis of individual and then cultural moral presumption. Cumulative, socially mediated transmission of the past consequences of such creation and intrapsychic reorganization constitutes group identity, culture itself, the canon of assumptions and values that underlie behavior, the eternal shield against the terrible unknown. The hero is the first person to have his internal structure, that is, his hierarchy of values and his behaviors, reorganized as a consequence of contact with an emergent anomaly. His descent into the underworld and subsequent reorganization make him a savior. But his contact with the dragon of chaos also contaminates him with the forces that disrupt tradition and stability. The reigning status quo stability may be only apparent. That is, the culture in its present form may already be doomed by as of yet not fully manifested change. The hero detects the dragon, or at least admits to its presence, before anyone else, and leads the charge. His return to the kingdom of threatened order may hardly be accompanied by praise, however, since the information he now carries, or perhaps is, will appear disruptive and destructive long before it proves redemptive. It is very easy to view the hero as the most profound danger to the state in consequence, and this would in fact be true if the absolute stasis of the state did not constitute a more fundamental danger. Figure 51, the crucified Redeemer as dragon of chaos and transformation, presents the Savior as serpent in keeping with his contamination by the unknown. Figure 52, the socially destructive and redemptive journey of the revolutionary hero, schematically presents the way of the Savior. The individual troubled by anomalous and anxiety-provoking experience is suffering equally from the disintegration, rigidity, or senility of the society within. The decision to mine such experience for significance and to destabilize the socially constructed intrapsychic hierarchy of behavior and values is, in consequence, equivalent, mythologically speaking, to the descent to the underworld. If this descent is successful, that is, if the exploring individual does not retreat to his previous personality structure and wall himself in, and if he does not fall prey to hopelessness, anxiety, and despair, then he may return to the community, treasure in hand, with information whose incorporation would benefit society. It is very likely, however, that he will be viewed with fear and even hatred as a consequence of his contamination with the unknown, particularly if those left behind are unconscious of the threat that motivated his original journey. His contamination is nothing to be taken lightly, besides. If the exploratory figure has in fact derived a new mode of adaptation or representation, necessary for the continued success and survival of the group, substantial social change is inevitable. This process of change will throw those completely identified with the group into the realm of chaos, against their will. Such an involuntary descent into the underworld is a very dangerous undertaking, as we have seen, particularly in the absence of identification with the hero. This means that it is primarily those persons who have sold their soul to the group who cannot distinguish between the hero and the dragon of chaos, between the hero and the environmental disaster, the death of the king, the dangerous stranger, or the heretical idea. The more tyrannical the attitude, the more those who hold it hate and fear the hero, victim and beneficiary of the creative illness. Let us lie in wait for the righteous man, because he is inconvenient to us and opposes our actions. He reproaches us for sins against the law and accuses us of sins against our training. He professes to have knowledge of God and calls himself a child of the Lord. Let us see if his words are true, and let us test what will happen at the end of his life. For if the righteous man is God's son, he will help him and will deliver him from the hand of his adversaries. Let us test him with insult and torture, that we may find out how gentle he is, and make trial of his forbearance. Let us condemn him to a shameful death, for according to what he says, he will be protected. Wisdom 2, 12-13 and 16-20. The tyrannical attitude maintains society in homogeneity and rigid predictability, but dooms it to eventual collapse. This arrogant traditionalism, masquerading as moral virtue, is merely unexpressed fear of leaving the beaten path, of forging the new trail. the entirely comprehensible but nonetheless unforgivable shrinking from destiny as a consequence of lack of faith in personal ability and precisely equivalent fear of the unknown. The inevitable result of such failure is restriction of meaning, by definition, as meaning exists on the border between the known and the unknown. Repression of personal experience, which is failure to update action and representation in the face of an anomalous occurrence, means damming up the river of life, means existence on the barren plain, in the paralyzed kingdom, in the eternal drought. It is personal experience, anathema to the fascist, eternally superseding group categorization and the interpretations of the dead, that is novel and endlessly refreshing. The security of predictable society provides an antidote to fear, but a too rigid society ensures its own eventual destruction. The future brings with it the unknown. Inflexibility and unwillingness to change therefore bring the certainty of extinction. Adaptive behavior is created and/or transformed by those driven to resolve the tension inevitably existing between dynamic personal experience and society, driven to resolve the tension between what they know to be true and what history claims. Readaptation during times of crisis does not necessarily constitute simple addition to the body of historical knowledge, although that is heroic endeavor as well. Full readaptation may necessitate revolutionary measures, partial or complete reincarnation, dissolution to constituent elements, and systemic reorganization. Such reorganization alters the meaning of experience and therefore the mythology of history and being. If resolution is not reached in time of crisis, mental illness for the individual or cultural degeneration for the society threatens. This mental illness, failure of culture, failure of heroism, is returned to domination by the unknown, in mythological terms expressed as involuntary incest, destructive union with the terrible mother. The revolutionary hero opens himself up to the possibility of advancement, to furtherance of his culture's central myth, by placing himself beyond the protective enclave of history and by exposing his vulnerability to the terrible nature of reality. In psychological terms, the hero discovers the limitations of history, discovers the nakedness of the father, Genesis 9:20-25. He must, therefore, challenge history and face what it had previously protected him from. Subsequent contact with the terrible mother means exposure to absolute mortal vulnerability, to the existence and consequence of ignorance, insanity, cruelty, disease, and death. The revolutionary hero faces the reality of his vulnerability and fights a battle with terror. The constant transcendence of the future serves to destroy the absolute sufficiency of all previous historically determined systems and ensures that the path defined by the revolutionary hero remains the one constant route to redemption. The revolutionary hero is embodiment and narrative representation of the action of consciousness itself. This mythically masculine principle emerges from its identity with chaos and culture and stands as an independently divine phenomenon, equivalent in potential strength to the destructive, generative, protective, and tyrannical forces that make up human experience. The hero is the individual who has found the third solution to his existential problems, the alternative to decadence and authoritarianism. When faced with a paradox whose solution is impossible in terms of the historical canon, that established axiomatically predicated hierarchy of values and assumptions, he takes inspired action and transcends his culturally determined limitations. Instead of denying the existence of the problem, and, therefore, tormenting those who cannot help but posit it, the revolutionary hero accepts the apparently impossible task of solution and of reuniting the warring opposites. He admits the possibility of successful solution not because the problem can be minimized, but because he believes human nature can expand to meet it. Such belief, faith, provides the precondition for courage. His act of voluntary transcendence re-exposes him to the brute force of the unknown and to the anger of the social group, but enables creative action. The hero's ability to risk standing alone, neither rejecting his culture because he is ignorant of its value, nor running away from it in panic because of fear, offers him the possibility of attaining true stature, although not necessarily acclaim or popularity. The true absolute in the individual, which can meet the absolute unknown, is the heroic aspect, which cannot be made finally subject to tyranny and is not ruled by the past. This is the spirit that created civilization, which must not be bound within the individual by abject subjugation to what has already been. The man who stands outside of culture necessarily places himself against nature and the world. This seems a hopeless position. But man knows little of his true potential, and in that ignorance lies his hope. This is the stone which was set at naught of you builders, which has become the head of the corner. Acts 4:11. The rise of self-reference and the permanent contamination of anomaly with death. The appearance of anomaly can be less or more upsetting. Small manifestations of the unknown disrupt relatively small tracts of explored territory. Larger manifestations may disrupt all things previously taken for granted, even things invisible. Upsetting manifestations of the unknown may occur as a consequence of outside forces, geological, meteorological, even cosmological. Similarly, social transformations may upset the stable and familiar. Wars, revolutions, and migrations make the conditional nature of everything taken for granted evident once more. Internal transformations are just as likely to introduce instability. The process of maturation, in and of itself, is sufficient to disrupt the previously stable and well-adapted personality and the little society of the family. Crises in adaptation may be brought about in childhood at the onset of schooling and first independent contact with the unmediated social world. The hormonal changes and new social demands of youth may likewise transform the happy and reasonable child into the depressed and hostile adolescent. Some internal transformations are also natural and social events. The ever-expanding human capacity for abstract thinking, for example, appears to be a consequence of biological and social forces working synergistically. The human brain has evolved exceptionally quickly from the phylogenetic perspective. The language-mediated interpersonal interaction characteristic of ever-larger human societies has provided that rapidly developing biological capacity with information whose sophistication and breadth is increasing exponentially. This means that the human mind increasingly manifests the capacity to upset itself, to produce revelations, so to speak, that knock gaping holes in the previously sufficient adaptive and protective social and interpsychic structures. The human capacity for abstraction has enabled us as a species and as individuals to produce self-models that include the temporal boundaries of existence. We have become able to imagine our own deaths and the deaths of those we love, and to make a link between mortal fragility and every risk we encounter. Emergence of such capacity, which reoccurs with the maturation of every new human being, introduces the most intractable anomaly imaginable into the developmental course of every life. Myth represents the ever-recurring appearance of this representational ability, this emergent self-consciousness, the heritable sin of Adam, as incorporation of the forbidden fruit, development of knowledge of good and evil, and consequent expulsion from paradise. This appearance is an event of cosmic significance, driving the separation of heaven and earth, making human experience something eternally fallen, something ever in need of redemption. The unknown has become permanently contaminated with death for Homo sapiens. This contamination has tremendously heightened our general motivation, our fear and curiosity, as we are able to perceive the potential that lurks behind every anomalous event. Our cultural creations, our great societies and the beliefs that accompany them, can be profitably viewed as driven by our knowledge of mortality and by the energy, the heightened alertness and penetrating consciousness such knowledge inspires. Our great transpersonal cognitive power, however, has not yet rescued us from the valley of the shadow of death. In the words of Origen of Alexandria, 2nd-century Christian theologian, "What man is found such an idiot as to suppose that God planted trees in paradise, in Eden, like a husbandman, and planted therein the tree of life, perceptible to the eyes and sense, which gave life to the eater thereof, and another tree, which gave to the eater thereof a knowledge of good and evil? I believe that every man must hold these things for images under which the hidden sense lies concealed." The metamythology of the Way portrays the manner in which specific ideas about the present, the future, and the mode of transforming one into the other are initially constructed and then reconstructed in their entirety when such transformation becomes necessary. This metamyth provides the deep structure linking other classes of myths, including those describing the current or pre-existent stable state, those that portray the emergence of something unexpected into that state, those that represent the dissolution of paradise in consequence, and those that describe the regeneration of stability. This cyclic pattern is essentially characteristic of the development of consciousness, of the capacity to act and represent, which is regarded from the mythic perspective as akin to the creation of the world. The previous place of stability, destroyed as a consequence of emergent anomaly, may be apprehended either as the paradise that once reigned from the perspective of the chaos engendered by its collapse, or as the rigid and tyrannical past from the perspective of revitalized and renewed order. Myths of paradise and the fall typically describe the first dynamic elements of the Way from the perspective of the chaos presently reigning, that is, from the position of the uncertainty and fear that characterizes profane and worldly life. From this standpoint, human life is existence in the valley of the shadow of death, contaminated by the unbearable and unreturnable gift of the knowledge of good and evil. Myths of redemption, that is, of the ascent from chaos, of the return to paradise, or of the flight to heaven, are tales designed to describe the process of remediation for the prehistoric fall. Such myths lay out a morality whose incorporation or incarnation constitutes cure for the spiritual paralysis engendered by emergent knowledge of death. The idea of primeval paradise, then paradise lost, of the origin of experience, the rise of self-consciousness, then permanent heritable fall, descent from grace, appears as a constant predicate of human culture distributed throughout the world. Even the most technologically primitive of people, whose styles of existence were often mistaken for paradisal by the Europeans who first encountered them, generally considered themselves fallen from an earlier condition of perfection. For them, like us, the noble savage was an ancestral Adamic figure who could communicate directly with God. As Iliada has it, "When heaven had been abruptly separated from the earth, that is, when it had become remote, as in our days, when the tree or liana connecting earth to heaven had been cut, or the mountain which used to touch the sky had been flattened out, then the paradisaic stage was over and man entered into his present condition." In effect, all myths of paradise show us primordial man enjoying a beatitude, a spontaneity and freedom which he has unfortunately lost in consequence of the fall, that is, of what followed upon the mythical event that caused the rupture between heaven and earth. The idea of paradise encompasses somewhat more than the previous place of stability. It is actually all previous places of stability concatenated into a single representation. Every previous place of stability becomes in this manner order, as such, balanced perfectly with potential, becomes existence without suffering in Eden or paradise in the walled garden of delight. Joseph Campbell notes, Eden signifies in Hebrew delight, a place of delight. Our own English word paradise, which is from the Persian peri, around, deza, a wall, means properly a walled enclosure. Apparently, then, Eden is a walled garden of delight. Paradise is the place where the perfect harmony of order and chaos eliminates suffering while bringing forth the necessities and pleasures of life without work or effort. Chaos and order are integrated perfectly in the paradisal state. Paradise therefore also partakes of the state of the cosmos before its division into the ever-warring constituent elements of experience. This uroboric condition or state, conceptualized as a mode of being that is free from or beyond opposition, is also by necessity that place or state of being where suffering, a consequence of limitation and opposition, does not exist. This form of symbolic representation seems somewhat paradoxical, as it is the dragon of chaos that generates dread anxiety when it manifests itself unexpectedly. However, context determines salience, determines meaning, in mythology as elsewhere. The conditions of existence, that is, the balance obtained by the forces of order, chaos, and consciousness, not infrequently appear as intolerable in and of themselves. In the state of anxiety and pain characterized by severe grief or depression, for example. From this perspective, the state of non-being, equivalent to identity with pre-cosmogonic chaos, is the absence of all possibility of suffering. In the state of ideation characterizing suicide, for example, the Great Mother beckons. A student of mine, who had undergone a relatively severe crisis of identity, told me the following story. I took a trip to the ocean. There were cliffs behind the beach. I was standing on one of the cliffs, looking out over the water. I was in a depressed state of mind. I looked out to the horizon. I could see the figure of a beautiful woman in the clouds. She gestured for me to come forward. I almost went over the edge before I came out of my fantasy. My wife told me a very similar tale. When she was in late adolescence, feeling somewhat unsettled, she took a camping trip on the sides of a deep riverbank near her hometown. She stayed overnight on a bluff overlooking a steep drop. In the morning, the fog came off the river and filled the valley. She walked to the edge. I saw the clouds below me. They looked like big, soft pillows. I imagined diving in where it was warm and comfortable. But part of me knew better. The state of non-existence, the state before the opening of Pandora's box, can under many conditions appear a state worth reattaining. The common metaphor of paradise as geographic place serves to concretize a complex state of affairs whose intrinsic nature would otherwise remain entirely beyond grasp. It brings down to earth the a priori conditions of the spirit and renders them initially comprehensible, at least in the symbolic sense. Paradise as place or state is perfected interpersonal interaction, the harmony of the lion and the lamb, as well as spiritual harmony, is the internal kingdom and the external kingdom simultaneously united as the kingdom of God. Paradise is also the world before it became profane, before innocence was lost. Myths of the paradise of childhood use the circumstances applying at the dawn of each individual life, prior to separation of mother and child, as metaphor for the place of beginnings. The symbiotic mother-child relationship is a union of elements that will in time become separate. The intimate union of two individuals at the beginning of a life comprises a state that is one thing and more than one thing simultaneously. This concrete example of a unity that is at the same time a plurality can be used in abstraction to represent the hypothetical pre-temporal state itself, where everything that would be more than one thing still existed in inseparable identity. This unity, the unviolated original state, tends to take on the affective evaluation of perfection, since it is the place where there is no conflict, no separation of opposites. Widespread iconic representations of the Holy Virgin Mother and Child, for example, Christian and non-Christian, might be regarded as crystallized fantasies about the affective nature of the origin. In the ideal mother-infant union, every desire remains absolutely bounded by love. The state of early childhood, more generally, symbolizes freedom from conflict, symbolizes honest, innocent, idyllic human existence, immersion in love, life before the necessary corruption of social contact, life preceding exposure to the harshly punitive conditions of physical existence. Childhood represents, perhaps is, existence prior to the discovery of mortality. This lack of contamination by knowledge of death lends childhood experience an ideal quality, which easily comes to serve the mythic imagination as model for the state of being that transcends the existential anxiety of adulthood. The child, father to the man, represents the past of man. Additionally, represents human potential and man's eternal hope for the future. The Hasidim believe, for example, that the Tzaddik, the perfect righteous man, finds that which has been lost since birth and restores it to man. In the Christian tradition, likewise, it is held that, except ye be converted and become as little children, ye shall not enter into the kingdom of heaven. Matthew 3:3. Maturation means expansion of ability, differentiation of self and world, transformation of possibility into actuality, but loss of potential as well, as anything developed develops in one direction and not in any of the innumerable alternatives. Growth, therefore, also means decline, as each step toward adulthood is one step closer to death. The initial paradisal state is typically disrupted in mythological representation by some fateful act undertaken by man, by some act that places him in opposition to his heavenly source. Such opposition is painful and is often portrayed as a dreadful mistake or sin. It is nonetheless the case that the origin of experience and history, that is, the origin of being itself, appears inextricably bound up with such opposition, with differentiation from the origin. The initial paradisal state, although characterized by absolute totality, nonetheless seems paradoxically flawed. It suffers from an indeterminate form of non-existence, lacks reality itself. There was something formless, yet complete, that existed before heaven and earth. Without sound, without substance, dependent on nothing, unchanging, all-pervading, unfailing. One may think of it as the mother of all things under heaven. The Tao Te Ching.